is safe. I don't want to see an archer. You know, I bring my kid there to the playground. Like, I don't want them to be exposed to this. And a lot of it was more just like, once you sat down and explained the program, everyone was totally understanding. And they want to see something happen with the deer population. They might be upset that it's a lethal control method, but once they understand that non-lethal is not an option at this moment, they're usually okay with it.
Could you talk a little bit more about the effects of the deer population on the plant life in the area?
Yeah, for sure. So, as I said, you know, deer eat a lot, like 7 pounds of food a day. That's a lot of food for, you know, Pitt did a study saying that they looked at the more economical side of deer management, but they made this prediction looking at prior studies that we might have up to 300 deer in Frick Park at a time. Take 300 and times it by 7. That's a lot of food being eaten every single day. So when deer are eating, they're munching on the, we'll say the native vegetation is the what they prefer. That's what they want. They want our gardens. They want, you know, our local or our native flora. So when they eat that and they remove it from the ground, because typically they pull and rip and they take the roots and everything with it, that leaves an open spot in our forest floor. Traditionally, what would happen is native seeds or whatnot would come in and fill that and hypothetically fill that void. But when we have 300 deer doing that at the same time, we're left with major gaps in our forest floor. So our ground has these gaps, and what's going to move in and fill that? It's probably going to be something that is deer resistant and traditionally an invasive species. So that's one of the reasons that we see things like garlic mustard, we see Japanese knotweed, and we see these species thriving in our parks because the deer aren't eating them. Nothing wants to eat them. So it's hard to replace once you start getting into, we're starting to spiral into more invasive predominant forest versus a native-based forest. And once you start that spiral, it's really hard to catch up. It's really, really hard to catch up. So we're seeing our native forest being replaced with more of an invasive-based forest cover or understory that the deer are not eating, and they're flourishing. They're doing great. But on the other hand, we see a deer population that's hungry, that's starving, and they're now starting to resort to moving out into the streets into risky environments or potentially even munching on invasive species that we have never seen them eat before. I saw a deer munching on Japanese knotweed in the middle of the summer, but that's what the food source was available for them.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Of course.
After speaking with Erica, we wanted to learn a little bit more from the perspective of the archers who participate in this program. We're catching up with one of them today, Walter Martin. Thanks for coming on the show, Walter.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't we start off with you telling us a little bit about yourself?
So I am an avid outdoorsman. I love being outside. I love hiking. I love going to the national parks. I like fishing, and I like archery hunting. So I love being outside. I love watching nature.
Sure. How'd you get into hunting and archery in the first place?
You know, I was I used to be in a business development position in the golf industry, and with that, I was a lot of the places I would go, golf courses, were in areas that were, you know, woods, nice habitats, and they would talk about hunting. And being like somebody who loved the outside, I just started to learn like what they were doing, and I got involved.
So do you only hunt with bow and arrow, or do you also hunt with guns?
I have only hunted with bow and arrow. So the bow and arrow season, the archery season, is from September through November, and so it's a beautiful time of the year to be in the woods.
Yeah, that makes sense. So on the deer management program, I guess, how did you hear about the program in the first place?
So as you know, follow, on Facebook, there's sites and pages that are dedicated to archery hunting, and it just came up in one of the groups. So I applied for it. You know, one of the challenges with archery hunting is trying to find places to hunt and also places that are convenient.
Awesome. And within the city, where do you hunt? Which parks?
I hunt Frick Park.
Frick Park. Awesome.
So Frick Park, it's split up into 10 different zones, and a hunter is assigned to each zone.
Okay. So you can only hunt within the zone that you're assigned?
Correct.
Okay. That makes sense. So
on a typical day when you're in the field hunting, just like walk us through your process. Like, what do you do to prepare when you're at home? When you show up, what do you do to set up? And like, what's it like? What kinds of hours are you maybe normally out there?
Since, you know, archery is fun and a sport, like we practice. So like really, when does it start? It starts in the spring as you practice and just keep getting better and better being archery and figuring out what you can do and what you can't do is what your limitations are. So it starts really with practicing and like moving forward as the season comes close. I would take walks in Frick Park around the area that I was planning to hunt and like see if I could see deer movement, see if I could see trails and prepare for that. If you're talking about like day of, like, you know, usually on Sunday, which is a non-hunting day throughout the state, I like, we'll just double check my equipment to make sure that everything's fine and I'll just practice a little more. And then I'll have my gear in my vehicle like the day of. I'll show up maybe, you know, if it's early morning, I'll show up before the sun comes up and leave by, you know, an hour or two after the sun's up. I try to walk in with civilian clothing on, not camo. I carry a backpack and I have my hunting clothes in that. The bow, I hunt with both a compound bow and a crossbow. I carry those in a bag as a big a plastic black bag. I pick up trash on the way and I just try to not make anybody nervous. So like my pre-hunt, that's basically it. I do have trail cameras out there when they're allowed 2 weeks before the season starts.
Hunting deer in Frick Park is a little bit unique in that it's in the city instead of, you know, in a more suburban or rural area like most hunting that I think people are aware of. What are some of the differences between hunting in Frick Park and hunting sort of out in the woods in the middle of nowhere?
The deer feel bubbles of safety. And like on the trails, they know they're humans. And like the deer have been very comfortable around people. They were a lot more 2 years ago when it started than they are right now. But if you were within what they would consider their bubbles of safety, like in between the trails, in the woods, like they would get spooked when they saw people in places they didn't normally see people. I mean, that part's different. I think the real key is the approach to hunting. First off, safety is number one. So when we're scouting our territory, it's okay, this is going to be a good spot that's not going to endanger anybody. But we definitely know, okay, this is, I can shoot uphill here. If I'm shooting in an elevated position, the arrow's not going to go anywhere. It's not going to fly. It's not like a gunshot, like a bullet that can travel a long distance. I don't think people realize we really don't shoot over 20, 25 yards.
Oh, pretty short.
Yeah, it's pretty short. And that's another huge difference in urban hunting. And especially with Frick Park and especially with this program, shot selection's unbelievably important. We have to look for a double lung shot that's going to put the deer down really, like, down quickly. In the wild, I've shot a deer that the arrow passed through its heart, and I think it still ran 80, 90 yards. If we're hunting in an urban environment and there's houses, you know, 80 yards can mean three or four houses. 80 yards can mean it runs towards the soccer field that the kids are practicing on.
Are you guys responsible for dressing the deer?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
So they have a station at all the parks where you would remove the deer and then field dress the deer.
Is this your first year in the program?
Second year.
Have you noticed any decrease in the number of deer?
Absolutely.
Okay.
A huge difference. The first year, deer would almost follow me in the woods. Yeah. Like, they were so docile. Like they were... And there were so many of them. It's definitely dropped down.
So if you could nerd out a little bit, what gear do you bring on your hunts? What kind of bow?
So I have two types of bow, two bows that I bring. One is a Bowtech compound bow, and that's, you know, and one is a crossbow. Crossbows have higher power, and I think it has more downing. Like, it's, you know, for double long shots, it's probably something that would help put the deer down as soon as possible.
difficult. Could you talk a little bit more about the testing process? Do they take you out to a range somewhere? Or?
We go to a range. You know, there's target set up. You don't know in advance what your target is. You don't know the distances. So you guess and practice. Like I practice. And for practice, I practice farther than I would like shoot like in the field. So they have three separate targets and you go there and you get one shot in each and you have to hit in a small window. And if you don't, you're out. Hmm. I tried out both years. If you harvest a certain amount of deer, I think it was four, you were invited back. So
how many deer would you harvest, in a typical season?
So I think the average was about, you know, six or seven. So.
Out of, on average, how many, like, trips do you think people are taking out to the parks in one season?
I think just off the top of my head, I think it was around, you know, 15 to 18. Candidly, I was a little more because I enjoy being out there.
Yeah.
So I love walking. So I would walk and just see what was going on. I'd jump in a tree and watch. And, you know, sometimes deer would walk under me. Like, it's like we are outside enthusiasts. So I saw a buck come out, and there was a raccoon that was around. The raccoon was walking up to the buck, and they were playful together, you know, and the buck, like, put his horns, like, it was like, and then the raccoon crawled up the tree and rested and flopped down in between three branches and fell asleep. And when it woke up 20 minutes later, it looked at me and its eyes got as big as saucers. It had no idea it was there. And then he like crawled away. But it's like you see cool interactions like this. You see fox, you see like, you know, birds. Like it's just beautiful out there. So I think I was out there about 30 times.
Oh, that's awesome. So it seems like you enjoy participating in this program a lot. What's been your favorite parts of it so far?
So it's a combination of being out and like, and again, enjoying the outside, enjoying like the sport of archery and of deer hunting. Part of the deer hunting too can be in part stalking and figuring out. It's almost like figuring out how are deer behaving? How is it different here? Like, what adaptations do I need to make here? Versus like being out in a state games land out in the middle of nowhere. You know, there's that. Honestly, it's also, you know, I do, you know, intervention and treatment advocacy for people in drug addiction and alcoholism. You know, part of it's service to the city. You know, it's, you know, there is a problem. There are people like with car accidents and things like that, like that I just think like I can be a part of. And I think the donations of hundreds of pounds of venison for the food pantries, I think is pretty cool. I feel really good about that.
So just to wrap us up, if you could tell our audience of people in Pittsburgh anything about the deer management program that you would like people to know, what would it be?
First, I really appreciate the support of the people that I've walked, you know, like that I've, I feel like I'm a member too of the Frick Park community and how much support that we've gotten. I think we're feeding a lot of people and I feel really good about that. Again, with my real job being in drug addiction and alcoholism, you know, I am by homeless shelters and I am by places that I know that they're getting, you know, good solid food and we're helping people out. Another thing, it's incredibly safe. We take 20, 25 yard shots. You're safe. You're like, your dogs are safe if there's on leashes. And I ran into a rabbi who was a little concerned because she saw a deer probably maybe like 60 yards away. She saw me and she's like, you're not going to shoot my dog, are you? And I started through the process and she was like, it's so safe. I go, yeah, you're totally fine.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on the show. You've been listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Today, we caught up with Walter Martin, one of the archers participating in the deer management program run by the city of Pittsburgh.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate you.
This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at the moving parts behind the Supreme Court's decision upholding the TikTok ban.
We're joined by Ramya Krishnan, an attorney at the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, to discuss these important free speech issues.
We'll also talk with longtime civil rights attorney Mark Kleiman about an important federal court ruling upholding free speech and academic freedom.
The court rejected an effort by Jewish parents and teachers to restrict the discussion of Israel and Palestine in the classroom.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
On January 17th, for the first time in modern American history, a unanimous Supreme Court upheld a sweeping prior restraint on free speech imposed by Congress, banning more than 170 million users in the U.S. from accessing the popular social media platform TikTok, that the court itself admitted allows users to create, publish, view, share, and interact with short videos overlaid with audio and text. In 2023 alone, U.S. TikTok users uploaded more than 5.5 billion videos, which were in turn viewed more than 13 trillion times around the world. To avoid the ban, the law requires TikTok's parent company, the China-based ByteDance, to divest its ownership. From January 18th to 19th, the ban was in effect for about 12 hours, until Donald Trump tweeted that as president he would grant a stay of execution, pending a potential sale of TikTok. It was only 12 hours, some may say, but it's estimated that during that time the ban blocked 6,750,000 videos that would have been viewed more than 178 million times worldwide. The ban is easily the most extensive act of censorship in human history. Shortly after he was sworn in, Trump signed an executive order purporting to suspend the ban for 75 days. But serious questions have been raised whether Trump's order is legal and enforceable. And despite the order, Apple and Google have still not reinstated TikTok at their stores, preventing new subscribers from accessing the platform. Meanwhile, the First Amendment rights of more than 170 million TikTok users hang in the balance. Joining us today to help make sense of this unprecedented First Amendment case and what might happen next is Ramya Krishnan. She is a senior staff attorney at the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University and also a lecturer in law at Columbia Law School. Her litigation focuses on issues related to government transparency, protest privacy, and social media. Ramya co-authored the Knight Institute's amicus brief in TikTok v. Garland, one of the lawsuits challenging the constitutionality of the TikTok ban, which resulted in the recent Supreme Court's decision. Ramya, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ramya, could you please set the stage by explaining exactly what Congress did in enacting the TikTok law?
Sure thing. So Congress passed a law called the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications back in April of last year. And what that law did is essentially tell TikTok's owner, ByteDance, which is headquartered in China, if it didn't sell TikTok within 270 days, that is before January 19, the app would be banned in the United States. January 19 has now come and gone. And so TikTok, formally at least by the statutes operation, is banned in the United States. And the way that ban is effectuated, it tells service providers to TikTok that if they provide any services that enable the distribution or updating of the app, that they are in violation of the law, and it empowers the attorney general to then seek very substantial penalties from those companies. The act also, I should mention, does empower the president to determine that other foreign adversary-controlled applications which pose a national security risk can also be subject to a forced divestiture, and in the event a divestiture doesn't happen, a ban.
So let's dig into this. As you and the Knight Institute see it, what are the fundamental constitutional flaws in that TikTok law? How did the Supreme Court deal with them? And where do you think the court went wrong?
Right. So, I mean, I think the place to start is to explain why we think this ban implicates the First Amendment. And it's because the Supreme Court has recognized that the First Amendment protects the right of Americans to access foreign media and ideas from abroad. And so by banning one of the most popular communications platforms in America, a platform that's used by 170 million Americans, Congress has substantially burdened the First Amendment rights of Americans to speak on the platform, to hear from others, to associate with the communities of their choosing on the platform. And the government has not done enough to justify this ban. It's pointed to a couple of national security threats, which it says it can't address through less restrictive means. It's pointed to, first of all, the risk of what it calls covert content manipulation. That is, the idea that China can, behind the scenes, influence the content that TikTok shows to Americans. The real fear here is that China will be able to influence the views of Americans and to distort public debate. And the other risk that they've pointed to is the risk of China being able to access the sensitive data of Americans through the app. Our response to those concerns is to say they're serious concerns here. I mean, not even the government claims that China has already done either of these things, but, you know, there's a risk that it could do so. But the fact remains that there are much less restrictive means that the government could pursue to address any legitimate interests it has. To the extent it's concerned about data privacy, it should be passing a comprehensive data privacy law that prevents not just TikTok, but any social media company in this company from vacuuming up massive troves of data about the users that use them. And to the extent it's concerned about covert content manipulation, well, the most direct way to address that is through disclosure. And the government hasn't explained why disclosure wouldn't be sufficient here. In terms of what the Supreme Court got wrong here, or where it went wrong, I mean, ultimately, it found here that this ban on TikTok doesn't violate the First Amendment. And that was exactly the wrong conclusion to reach in this case. It's an irony, actually, that at the start of this per curiam opinion, the court opens up with this exhortation from Justice Frankfurter about taking care to apply established rules to new problems, lest the court embarrass the future. But unfortunately, that's exactly what the court did. At a very fundamental level, what went wrong is the court turned a blind eye to what virtually any ordinary person looking at the law could see, which is that this was a hugely important First Amendment case, a hugely important free speech case. Because the ban didn't explicitly call out user speech, the court saw it as implicating only corporate control. And it didn't matter that the reason Congress was concerned about control had everything to do with expression. That is, its hostility to how TikTok is currently moderating the app, and a fear that China could use the app to persuade Americans of ideas it doesn't like.
interesting. Rami, you've sort of answered my next question, but I'd like to go back to this for a second. And that is that supporters of the ban argue, as you've noted, that China poses a real threat to the privacy of millions of Americans, and that free speech advocates are foolishly elevating theoretical First Amendment concepts over the best interests of the American people. Are there any other ways you would respond to those supporters other than to acknowledge, as you have, that we haven't seen any evidence of misuse by China?
Yes. I mean, you know, first of all, I would concede that the government absolutely has a compelling interest in protecting the privacy of Americans' data. That is an interest of the highest order. But the fact remains that legislators who are genuinely concerned about that problem, as they should be, have better options at their disposal. And they should start by passing a comprehensive privacy law that restricts what social media companies can collect and restricts what data brokers can sell. I mean, it's noteworthy, I think, that as part of the same package in which, you know, the TikTok ban was passed, Congress also passed a law that would prevent data brokers from sharing the sensitive data of Americans with foreign adversaries. And one of the arguments that TikTok made in the case is that, you know, that's fair enough. You could extend that law to companies like ours. That's an argument that I think the Supreme Court and in its decision never explains, never really addresses, never really explains why it would be inadequate to protect the data privacy of Americans.
And you make such a good point, because we're balancing the free speech rights of 170 million people as against other remedies that the court could have upheld. Let me turn to a different approach. Political winds can change. Today's friend can become tomorrow's enemy. Who knows what media outlets President Donald Trump or any future president or Congress may decide to ban as a, quote, foreign adversary, and with the Supreme Court now giving them a free pass. Politico is a German company. The Guardian is British, Reuters is Canadian, Financial Times is Japanese, and Univision is Mexican. The BBC is British, and we could go on and on. Could the TikTok ban be the start of a broader crackdown on foreign-owned media platforms in the United States if it was in the hands of a future president?
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is, you know, quite possibly, and this is exactly what we feared, what the rest of the free speech community feared when Congress took this extraordinary step of banning such a popular foreign media platform in this country. The Supreme Court's decision, I think, gives this administration, future administrations, a very powerful weapon to wield against foreign-owned media whose coverage, whose content moderation practices they don't like. And I mean, already the actions taken by this Trump administration show that it isn't just interested in consolidating power over the digital public sphere. It also wants to punish newspapers, broadcast TV, Trump himself, and that his administration don't like because of how they cover what they're doing. The president has called on the Federal Communications Commission to revoke licenses for broadcast television stations because he disagrees with their content and coverage. We have the new FCC chair, Brendan Carr, reviving three complaints against broadcast stations accused of bias against Trump. Those complaints had previously been dismissed by the former chair in what she called a stand for the First Amendment. So the intent is there. And now the court has further empowered this administration and future ones to go after their enemies. It's given them a nifty new way of evading the First Amendment, essentially, by going after corporate structure and property relations. That is, by going after speech indirectly rather than directly, the court has essentially said you can have a get out of jail free card. And not only this, but the court has empowered the government actors to launder their motives. Notably, one reason the court declined to apply the most stringent First Amendment scrutiny available in this case, strict scrutiny, is because it found that not only was the law sort of content neutral on its face, it said, well, this data privacy rationale, it has nothing to do with content. And we concede that the government has advanced a further rationale here. It's pointed to this covert content manipulation rationale, which is really just a guise for saying that it didn't like how the current mix of content on TikTok. But it said, where you have mixed justifications, where you have one content-based rationale and another content-neutral rationale, well, the existence of the content-neutral rationale essentially means that the law doesn't fall afoul of the First Amendment, or at least doesn't trigger strict scrutiny, because the government still has a legitimate reason that they can point to for doing what they did, but that essentially just allows the government to launder impermissible motives by being able to point in litigation to a legitimate one.
I wanted to go back for a brief second to something you said about privacy legislation to underscore for listeners that there is no federal privacy legislation. Right now, it's done by the states and by sectors, such as the health sector. On Inauguration Day, as you know, Trump issued a 75-day suspension of the ban. What exactly did his executive order claim to do? And do you think it will hold up legally?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the executive order does a few things. It instructs the Attorney General not to take any action to enforce the act for 75 days to provide his administration with, and I'm quoting from the order here, an opportunity to determine the appropriate course of action with respect to TikTok. It promises protection from future action against entities in violation of the act during that 75-day period and the period directly preceding his signing of the order. Because remember, under the terms of the act, the app was banned January 19, but Trump was only inaugurated on the 20th. And finally, the executive order directs the Attorney General to issue letters to service providers stating that there hasn't been any violation of the statute and that there isn't any liability for the conduct that had occurred during those times. So President Trump has claimed that this executive order has saved TikTok, but the order doesn't really do that. It just makes the app entirely dependent on President Trump's whims and consolidates his power over the digital public sphere. Right now, TikTok is entirely under his thumb because he can change his mind and the company won't want him to. And that could be used as leverage against the company. I mean, we don't know that Trump is going to do this, but if there are certain content moderation practices of the app that he doesn't like, well, he could influence the company to alter its practices by threatening to put it back under the ban if it doesn't accede to his demands. The executive order also essentially flouts the law that Congress passed, because it says that service providers who aren't in violation of the law, or says that they're not in violation of the law, when they clearly are. It directs the Attorney General not to pursue enforcement when the Act tells the Attorney General that it has to pursue enforcement. And although the Act provides the President an opportunity to extend the deadline for 90 days, the executive order doesn't claim to draw any authority from that provision. And in any event, an extension under the Act is available only if there has been significant progress towards divestiture and specific conditions are met. And it's not even clear that there's a deadline to extend anymore, as this initial period for divestiture had expired before Trump even took office. So ultimately, this isn't a win for free speech, and it certainly isn't a win for the rule of law. I have already been clear, I think, during this interview and suddenly through the Knight Institute's advocacy about the TikTok ban, that this ban is terrible policy. In our view, it's unconstitutional, and we wish that the court had made that clear. But overriding a duly enacted law by executive fiat sets a dangerous and anti-democratic precedent.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. I'm Heidi Boghossian, and my co-host Stephen Rohde and I are interviewing Ramya Krishnan to talk about the TikTok case.
Ramya, in many ways, the First Amendment has been a common ground for liberals and conservatives on the U.S. Supreme Court. This case seems like an exception to that. How would you assess this current court when it comes to First Amendment rights? And where does the TikTok decision, a unanimous decision, fall in that analysis?
Yeah, that's a great question. You're right that the First Amendment has often cut across sort of traditional ideological divisions in the court. You know, certainly we had this, the court's recent decision in Moody versus NetChoice, a case which concerned Texas's and Florida's social media laws, laws which essentially forced the companies to carry certain content that they would prefer not to carry. And the court in that case took a very strong First Amendment stand, saying that, look, content moderation activities of these platforms are fully protected by the First Amendment, that it's that these activities are protected just as the editorial decision making of newspapers has historically been protected by our First Amendment precedent, and that it is not a legitimate interest for the state to interfere with these activities in its pursuit of ideological, achieving its vision of ideological balance on the platforms. And so you might regard that as a very strong First Amendment decision. And so it's interesting to contrast that decision with the decision of the court in the TikTok case, which fails even to recognize that it's, you know, a free speech case at all. I mean, it's notable that the court, you know, actually doesn't decide whether the ban attracts First Amendment scrutiny. It simply says, we're going to assume for the sake of argument that it attracts First Amendment scrutiny. But the fact that it treated that question as a close call, a question whether banning a extremely popular communications platform in this country, a forum for so much public discourse, treating that as a close call suggests that maybe there's quite a significant loophole to the First Amendment that the government can make use of. I think the other thing that was striking is just the court's deference to the government's national security claims. And obviously, this isn't the first national security case that the court has done this. And many have recognized that the court has often engaged in, you know, national security exceptionalism. That is to afford deference where usually it would apply stringent scrutiny. And so I think we saw some of that here. And so, you know, to what extent is this decision a bellwether? I think it's difficult to say. It suggests to me that maybe the court isn't necessarily going to be the bulwark that we need it to be on the First Amendment, that the court may allow laws that clearly implicate the speech rights of millions of Americans to evade real scrutiny on a technicality, especially where the government cries national security. And this decision may encourage the government, government actors and Congress in particular, to effectuate censorship through ever more creative means by achieving speech regulation through indirect means like regulating corporate structure and property relations. Now, I hope that isn't the case. I think the best case scenario is that this decision is limited to these facts, or at least to the particular national security claims that the government made here, which the court took seriously. And I think there are resources in the opinion to cabinet in that way. The court does make very clear that it is narrowly focused on the circumstances before it, and that it doesn't intend to prejudge this kind of regulation of different, you know, other social media platforms. But there's a lot in this opinion that worries me.
Ramya, what is Project Texas? And was that TikTok's attempt to avoid a ban?
Yes. So Project Texas was a plan that TikTok proposed in the context of negotiations with the U.S. government. It was part of TikTok's effort to mitigate the national security concerns that the government had expressed about the platform. And so the plan had two main components, the first of which was meant to address data privacy concerns. So to address those concerns, the project created a U.S. subsidiary called the U.S. Data Security to manage U.S. user data. And as part of that plan, TikTok said that the subsidiary would store data on Oracle Cloud infrastructure and that the subsidiary would be staffed by U.S.-based employees. So essentially it was saying, we're going to keep all U.S. user data in the U.S. by storing it on cloud infrastructure based in the U.S., and we're only going to let it flow out of the U.S. in a limited set of circumstances, such as when a U.S. user messages someone based outside the U.S. To address the government's other set of concerns, which had to do with content and the risk that the Chinese government could influence content on the platform in some way, TikTok said that it would house key content moderation functions within its U.S. subsidiary and that Oracle would inspect source code and TikTok's recommendation algorithm would be subject to review by third-party auditors. So it put a lot on the table, but the court essentially dismissed this plan out of hand. It deferred to the fact that executive branch officials didn't consider these guardrails adequate. Its opinion doesn't really interrogate for itself why those guardrails might be inadequate. And it doesn't interrogate at all the specifics of the plan itself. And I think it was able to do this in part because it decided not to apply strict scrutiny and instead to apply intermediate scrutiny. But I think worse still, it sort of watered down even intermediate scrutiny to get there. But, you know, it emphasized that in applying intermediate scrutiny, especially because this was a national security case, it was going to give, you know, very significant latitude to the government in deciding what was going to be effective in achieving its interest. And so because the government said that anything short of a forced sale or ban would be insufficient, the court essentially credited that. It would have been better had the court actually explained in its opinion why Project Texas was insufficient to address the government's concerns.
Ramya, how can our listeners follow you and the work of the Knight First Amendment Institute?
Well, they can go to our website, Knight, that's Knight with a K, Columbia.org, and sign up for our newsletter. And we're also now on Blue Sky, so they can follow us our handle is at KnightColumbia.org.
Thank you so much for being with us today on Law and Disorder, and we hope to stay in touch.
Me too. I had a lot of fun chatting with you both.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
As Israel's war in Gaza and the West Bank rages on, the free speech battles here in the United States continue, with Congress, state legislatures, and college administrators trying to silence pro-Palestinian protests by conflating criticism of Israel with the odious epithet of anti-Semitism. Pro-Palestinian groups are being banned, students are being disciplined, and faculty members are being suspended and fired. But last November, there was some hopeful news when a federal court rejected attempts by Jewish parents and teachers to remove an ethnic studies curriculum from the Los Angeles Unified School District that they had labeled anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist. On November 30, 2024, in a 49-page ruling, U.S. District Judge Fernando M. Algren wrote that a system of education, quote, which discovers truth out of a multitude of tongues, unquote, must allow teachers and their students, quote, to explore difficult and conflicting ideas. He added that, quote, we must be careful not to curb intellectual freedom by imposing dogmatic restrictions that chill teachers from adopting the pedagogical methods they believe are most effective, unquote. The ruling represents a welcome rebuke to the efforts of Republican state legislators and conservative parent groups to try to restrict the teaching of comprehensive American history in public schools, to ban books that examine that history, as well as racism, sexism, and LGBTQ issues, and to eliminate programs that seek to ensure diversity, equity, and inclusion in American education. In 2022, a group calling itself Concerned Jewish Parents and Teachers of Los Angeles, comprised of what the lawsuit calls Jewish Zionist Teachers and Parents of Students, sued the Los Angeles Unified School District, United Teachers of Los Angeles, its President Cecilia Mayard Cruz, the Liberated Ethnic Studies Model Curriculum Consortium, Teresa Montaño, the consortium's secretary, and Guadalupe Cardona, its co-founder. To discuss the important free speech and academic freedom issues involved in this case, we've invited the lawyer who represented the ethnic studies curriculum and the individual defendants. Mark Klayman is a former activist and organizer. I consider him a current activist and a longtime civil rights and human rights attorney. With extensive experience in whistleblower protection, he has brought cases that expose massive fraud against public programs and has forced drug companies, nursing home chains, and defense contractors to repay hundreds of millions of dollars. Since 2019, he has devoted thousands of hours to defending activists, scholars, and students who've been attacked for their defense of Palestinian human rights. Mark, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mark, to begin, please describe the Liberated Ethnic Studies model curriculum and what the plaintiffs in this lawsuit were complaining about.
Thank you, Steve. The Liberated Ethnic Studies model curriculum grew out of a state of California requirement that before students graduated from high school, they had to have at least one semester of ethnic studies. And ethnic studies teachers from high schools all over the state, as well as some college professors, donated their time and labor to the State Department of Education to put together a model curriculum. It was acclaimed nationally by ethnic studies experts until it was discovered it included the option for teachers to actually discuss Palestine as a modern day example of settler colonialism. And various Zionist groups in our state legislature became alarmed. The Department of Education was pressured to remove that piece of the curriculum, and every single educator who had volunteered their time said, take my name off of this document. This doesn't represent my work anymore. And they created the Liberated Ethnic Studies Consortium, which then developed its own curriculum untrammeled by political censorship. And they worked to help school districts use it and adopt it throughout the state. And they worked to train high school educators in how to have these very important but very sensitive discussions in their classrooms.
Mark, the judge called the lawsuit confusing, noting that the complaint is, quote, difficult to understand and contains a morass of largely irrelevant and sometimes contradictory allegations. What were these parents and teachers asking the court to do?
What the supposed parents and teachers, and I say this because the group was actually organized by a lawyer from 3,000 miles away, demanded was a form of Israeli exceptionalism. They wanted Israel to somehow be not magically exempt from criticisms of other examples of people moving in, taking over land, kicking out indigenous people. It was acceptable to talk about what happened to the Native Americans in the U.S., to the First Nations in Canada, to Aboriginal tribes in Australia, but you couldn't talk about what Israel had done to the Palestinians. So that's the first thing they wanted. They wanted Israel to be treated differently than everybody else. The second thing they demanded, the essentially political program of Zionism, be accorded special status as religious doctrine that could not be contradicted in the school system. Never mind the fact that comparative religion courses and coursework dealing with Southern Asia talk about the discrimination against the Dalit caste. Never mind the fact other religions are looked at not through hostile, but through critical lenses. They wanted this one Zionist thread of Zionism, which is just a relatively modern part of some Jewish religious belief, to be accorded protected status that no other religion gets. And their strategy for doing this, and this is taken right from their lawsuit, was to prohibit, and this is a direct quote, any language in any teaching materials asserting that Zionism is not a Jewish belief, denouncing the Jewish belief in the land of Israel as the land promised by God to the Jewish people, or the Jewish belief in Zionism, or asserting that the state of Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people is illegitimate, or asserting as a fact that the Jewish state is guilty of committing such horrific crimes against others as ethnic cleansing, land theft, apartheid, or genocide, or that the Jewish people are not indigenous to the land of Israel or to the Middle East, or denying the state of Israel the right to self-defense, and or denying the historical or religious connection between the Jewish people and the land of Israel. That's how they framed it.
Thank you, Mark. It sounds like a sweeping set of principles that they wanted to indoctrinate the students with. Let me ask you this. As part of your defense strategy, you brought an anti-SLAPP motion. Tell our listeners what that is and why such motions are important to help defendants protect their First Amendment rights.
Sure. So SLAPP is an acronym. It's S-L-A-P-P, and it stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. One thing very common in the United States is that for people and institutions that have money to use the legal system to bully those that have less of it and have fewer resources. So you typically find powerful interests trying to use the courts to, if they're lucky, muzzle people, and if they're not lucky, tie up movement groups in court systems, raising judicial fights, raising money for lawsuits, etc. A number of states, nearly all of them now, have laws that are designed to protect people from this, and they're called anti-SLAPP laws. The way the law works in California is that if somebody files a frivolous lawsuit against you because they don't like what you've said about a public issue or have said in a public forum, the media, a public hearing, a petition, anything like that, you can file a motion to strike their lawsuit. And if successful, you can get the judge to order they have to pay for your lawyer. So the idea is to even the playing field and to make people think twice before taking advantage of their wealth to file these kinds of suits. Here, we said we have a group of ethnic studies teachers who are working with school boards and working with community groups on an issue that is of undeniable public importance, given how much the U.S. is spending to help Israel slaughter people. It's got to be addressed publicly. It's on the front pages all the time. You, we said to the Coalition of Jewish Parents and Teachers, you're suing people because you don't like what we say. So we're going to file a special motion to get the complaint struck because you're really just using this lawsuit to muzzle us and retaliate against us for our speech.
Mark, the judge relied heavily throughout its decision on an important Ninth Circuit federal appellate decision in the case of Montero v. Tempe Union School District, which was decided in 1998. Please tell us about that case and what it stands for.
There are a string of cases where the Court of Appeals out here for the Ninth Circuit has said exactly this. There was a case where there was a teacher in the Maricopa County Community College District who was a blatant Islamophobe and said horrible racist things about Arabs, Islamophobic things about Muslims, and the Ninth Circuit told the student who sued over this, listen, claiming, even though it's a lie, that Islam mandates terrorism and the killing of non-Muslims does not violate the free exercise of religion clause and does not keep you as a Muslim student from practicing your religion. All it does is annoy you and make you uncomfortable, and you have to live with it. Apparently, the plaintiffs in our lawsuit would have the court believe that there should be one rule for Muslims and another different rule for Zionists.
The trial judge in your case upheld the Ninth Circuit rulings. He was bound by them, which is going to make an interesting appeal when this case goes to the Ninth Circuit. But take a few minutes. Tell us what Judge Alguin held. What were his specific rulings as it related to this curriculum?
It would be challenging to encapsulate all 49 pages of this, but let me give you what I think are the highlights. First of all, the First Amendment analysis is central to this. He said two things about the First Amendment. The first is, listen, whether the plaintiffs like it or not, we still live in a pluralist democracy. And the fact that there's discord and friction doesn't mean you can ban the sources of it the way people objected to secondhand smoke and banned cigarette smoking. This is the lifeblood of how our society works. Because of that, when the Supreme Court has ruled that some burdens on religion are permissible, so long as they are not unreasonable, there's nothing unreasonable about exposing high school students to criticisms of one sect of one religion, so long as nobody, of course, was generalizing and saying, all Jews this or all Jews that. That would be real anti-Semitism, the same way of saying Islam as a religion believes in X is Islamophobic. And the court said you simply cannot claim that having kids sit in a classroom and discuss a hot topic political issue makes it impossible for them to live their lives as Jews. The second point, what the Supreme Court has called and what Judge Olkin referred to as the robust exchange of ideas, which means that students have a right to receive information and to critically process that information, whether they agree or disagree, and not just regurgitate dates and names on demand the way an ATM machine forks out $20 bills when you push the right button. That's not a real education. Third point is that although the plaintiffs claimed to be on about what was going on in the classroom, they wanted an absolute ban. They wanted to shut these teachers up from what they were saying to other teachers and what they were saying in school board meetings about what the education ought to be. They really wanted to muzzle anybody who believed in Palestinian human rights and was willing to talk about it. The court recognized that those things are impermissible under our First Amendment. There's a reason it's the First Amendment, and that is the first and biggest motivating principle here. In Judge Olkin's decision, when, as Heidi pointed out before, he called some of the language in the plaint confused and contradictory, you have to wonder how a couple of very well-educated plaintiffs' lawyers managed to produce an attack that is essentially unhinged. And you need to understand where these people are coming from. The lead lawyer, Jerome Marcus, rather famously filed the first Trump attack on the 2020 election results in Pennsylvania, breathlessly claiming, which he later had to walk back and admit was false, that Trump observers were not being allowed to watch the hand counting of votes. That was the claim in the lawsuit. When asked for details by the judge, he very reluctantly had to admit that, yes, Trump observers were in there. He's got a history. His local group working with him is an outfit called Judicial Watch. They sued Dr. Fauci they didn't sue him personally, but they sued people trying to protect public health measures against COVID. They most famously started the unfounded rumor that the Clintons had actually murdered their aide, Vince Foster, in the just beginning days of the Clinton administration back in 1992. The lawyers who filed and prosecuted this lawsuit have a long history of right-wing legal and political activities, from working to invalidate the 2020 election results in Pennsylvania to attacking public health measures during the COVID crisis. And of course, these people have worked hand in glove with folks who want to simply eliminate ethnic studies and suppress any diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts across the country. The attack on this particular small piece of the curriculum that was proposed in California is just the spear point. What they really want to do is keep ethnic studies from being taught as anything other than a victorious melting pot kind of theory, which is simply ahistorical. They've seized on Palestine and these bogus claims of anti-Semitism, and they're really misusing what they claim to be religious as a vehicle for furthering a right-wing agenda, just like the cake shops and the clerk who wouldn't issue marriage licenses. There's nothing religious about this. It's purely political in religious clothing.
Mark, we have just a few minutes remaining, but would love your response to a short quote from Jonathan Friedman, who is the director of free expression and education at PEN America, and who has written a lot about the role of public school, what they owe students. He has said that diversity of thought has been the core of our pluralistic identity. Do you consider the court ruling you've won in this case as making a contribution to the kind of diversity of thought Friedman references in general, and particularly in the debate over Israel and the Palestinians?
I do. The ruling helps create and maintain a space where this can be talked about and where at least people can meet in their communities and decide whether or not students are only going to get the popular government Trump or previously Biden Blinken line on the Middle East. Diversity of thought requires multiple sources of information. And this ruling says you can't shut down that flow of information into a classroom. It's essential.
Mark, like you, the co-hosts of Law and Disorder are lawyers who believe in using the law as a tool to achieve social justice. Why did you take on this case to represent clients who had been accused of the ugly epithet of anti-Semitism?
Well, the sad thing is that there really is anti-Semitism in the United States, and there really is dangers to Jews. You just have to look at the Tree of Life assassination murders or the shootings at the temple in Southern California. The reality is that the danger comes from the right and the ultra-right, and the idea that somebody is anti-Semitic simply because they criticize Israel would be like saying someone was Islamophobic because they objected to Saudi Arabia killing and dismembering a Washington Post journalist. It's nonsense. And it's offensive as nonsense. And as a Jewish American, I'm really deeply angered by having my name and my identity being used to invoke war crimes and to justify or excuse apartheid policies. I took this case because it's important that people understand that a great number of Jews don't buy this and won't stand for it, especially, by the way, although I'm not younger, almost a majority of Jews under 40 recognize that Israel is an apartheid state and don't support any of these principles. And it's important that people understand that.
Mark, how can listeners follow both this case and your work?
Go to liberatedethnicstudies.org.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder, and even more so for everything you do every day in this cause. It's important to us. It's important to our listeners and, frankly, to the American people. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Steve and Heidi, and I am so grateful for your support and commitment to educating people about all of this. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread